DACA recipients are celebrating, preparing for a hurricane during a pandemic, and understanding Juneteenth. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. There are an estimated 600,000 DACA recipients in the U.S. who will not face the immediate threat of deportation. In a 5-4 vote, the U.S. Supreme Court found that the Department of Homeland Security's effort to rescind the deferred action for childhood arrivals is arbitrary and capricious. So, what happens next? Also, we're in the midst of the 2020 hurricane season. How will evacuations and shelters work when we're all supposed to practice social distancing? Finally, 40 years ago, Miamians took to the street to protest the killing of an unarmed black man, Arthur McDuffie. We'll talk with the producer of the film, When Liberty Burns, about that history. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. An estimated 650,000 people living in the United States will not face the immediate threat of deportation. The Supreme Court issued its opinion this morning in a 5-4 vote. They found the Trump administration's case to end the deferred action for childhood arrivals was not strong enough. Chief Justice John Roberts issued the deciding fifth vote in what came as a surprise to legal experts and immigrant advocacy groups that are following the case closely. Romina Montenegro is a 21-year-old DACA recipient living in Little Havana. She spoke with WLRN about the decision this morning.
I'm in shock. I'm so full of joy because of the decision, but still in shock because it really could have gone either way. Of course, there were so many problems with it. There were so many ridiculous holes in their argument, which is why they ruled it arbitrary and capricious. So it's one of the biggest weights off our shoulders because now we, for the time being at least, we have that protection from deportation.
She's one of tens of thousands of DACA recipients living in Florida, according to the Migration Policy Institute. Joining us now to discuss is WLRN's Tim Padgett and WLRN reporter Danny Rivero. Tim, Danny, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Luis.
Danny, I want to start with you. What was the justification for Supreme Court Justice John Roberts to continue the Obama-era program Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals? All right. Danny, are you there? All right. We're having issues connecting with Danny. Tim, just let me throw that question to you. You know, what was the justification for John Roberts to continue the program?
Well, it was mainly administrative. People should not think that the Supreme Court today was saying that DACA is a kosher program. Let's say that what President Obama did in creating deferred action for childhood arrivals was legal, et cetera. What they're saying is that the Trump administration made a raft of administrative and documentative errors in its approach to claiming that that DACA was illegal and that it had the right to then rescind it. I think they just, as they said, it was arbitrary and capricious the manner in which the Trump administration went about making this argument and essentially threw it back to the Trump administration, said, look, you can try again, but if you come back to us, make sure you do a little better job this time.
Okay, Danny, I think we have you now. We have you by phone. You there?
Yep, I'm here.
All right, perfect. Sorry about that. All right, so Danny, ending DACA was a campaign promise that was made by Trump when he was a candidate 4 years ago. What was the lead up to the Supreme Court ruling today?
Right. This was a pretty major promise that Trump made in his 2016 campaign, actually. And prior to the ruling, we heard from Trump and many of his ardent supporters that this program needed to be ended. Of course, it was former Attorney General Jeff Sessions that declared that the program was illegal, which led to the Department of Homeland Security reversing this. Like Tim said, the big problem that played out in the trial is that they didn't cross the T's and dot the I's of what they did in anticipation of actually rescinding this and reversing it. And it's something that's kind of emerged as a pattern in the Trump administration, of playing fast and loose, even with policies that they do have the legal right to change, but just not getting the proper public input, not explaining itself to the extent that they're obligated to do, even when they're making decisions that they that they have the ability to make.
And Danny, what did legal experts expect to happen today?
There was, it depends who you ask, right? But there was, if you look at it through one view, there was a pretty clear precedent on this, because this decision is actually very much in line with the decision we got last year, which was about the question of putting the citizenship question on the census. And this was shot down by the exact same justices for the exact same reason. The Supreme Court said, you guys didn't go through the process of you know, illustrating why this is necessary when you made this decision. And so because you didn't come up with a decision until after, because you didn't come up with an explanation of this until after the fact, we're going to shoot it back down to you. You have to figure out how to do this right from scratch. And then, you know, the clock ran out on that question for the census question. So the censuses were sent out without that question. And then now
I was thinking about this poll that came out today or yesterday. Politico Morning Consult published a poll, and they found that 68% of Republicans, 71% of conservatives say that Dreamers, including DACA recipients, should be protected. So why is this a big push by the Trump administration?
It's a good question, and it's worth saying that even for as many times as he's said that he wants to end it, President Trump has spoken in support of it. He tweeted in 2017, does anyone really want to throw out good, educated, accomplished young people who have jobs, some serving in the military? That's a direct quote. Part of the issue with this, of course, goes back to when President Obama created this program. He was asking Congress to do this, to pass a law. And he said explicitly at one point, he said, if Congress won't act on this, then I'll act on this. And President Obama did this executive action. And this, even DACA, when it was in place and as it's upheld today, it's only a temporary solution. Like, really, Congress needs to step in and make this a permanent thing if they want to do so. And that will settle the score once and for all, because if not, you're going to have every administration coming in with different rules and different opinions on this.
Tim, you spoke with DACA recipient Romina Montenegro in Little Havana this morning. We heard from her at the top of the segment. So how closely was she following this case?
Oh, very closely. I mean, she's been watching this for a year and a half now. She told me quite avidly every day with every new news development. As we pointed out, she's a 21-year-old college student who's going to probably graduate in the fall. She's got a future ahead of her here. She's been here since the age of two. So the thought of being deported back to Argentina, to a country she's has no remembrance of whatsoever, was quite a nightmarish, daunting prospect for her.
Was she preparing for that possibility that this could have gone the other way?
I think any DACA recipient had to be preparing for that possibility, and she certainly was. But as she said in the quote we played at the outset of the show, this is like a 1,000-pound weight lifted off her shoulders, at least for the time being, because now there is not that threat of being deported back to a country that technically she was born in but has no familiarity with whatsoever.
And what's the situation with her family back in Argentina? What would be the option for her if she had to go back?
Her parents have since been able to move back here, she told me, and they're getting their legal residency. She also has an older brother who is also a DACA recipient. So this is a weight lifted off the shoulders of probably the entire family, not just her.
How large is the community of DACA recipients in South Florida? And are they all young like Romina, their students, or are they working though, right?
Right. Most of them are in their teens or 20s, maybe early 30s. But Florida really does not have that large a share of DACA recipients. You have to remember that about 80% of DACA recipients in this country originally came from Mexico. So what that means is you're going to see most of them in states like California and Texas, which make up the lion's share of DACA recipient population in this country. In Florida, we have about 33,000 DACA recipients, but that makes up only about 4% of the entire DACA population in the country.
Again, I'm talking with WLRN reporters Tim Padgett and Danny Rivero. The Supreme Court ruled this morning against the Trump administration in their efforts to end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. You can find more coverage from NPR on this story. Just go to WLRN.org. So, Danny, the Supreme Court ruling found the Trump administration, again, can't end the program effective immediately, but what are the next steps for the administration? And, I mean, I did hear on NPR today, they don't think that they could have this resolved before the election.
Administratively and procedurally, I guess, the Supreme Court shot this back down to a lower court and said, you know, the federal government needs to come up with better rationalizations for doing this, and you know, it can proceed from there. At no point did the court say this was bad policy or anything of the sort. It just said the way it did it was not proper. But that does present a problem for the Trump administration, because there is a prospect that there is an election coming up, and the clock could simply run out. It could just run out, and then with DACA, ending DACA, one of the really core promises of the 2016 campaign for President Trump, could just be left on the floor. And actually, it's worse than that, because not only is the program still in place, but they lost a major Supreme Court ruling, and they got smacked down at the Supreme Court. So not only is it here, but they got slapped on the hand for even trying to remove it.
We also heard from Juan Escalante, a DACA recipient and immigration advocate from South Florida.
The next steps are a little bit uncertain. The president could still terminate the program if he so chose to do it in other ways or manners. However, what we're calling for right now is for the president and the administration to recognize and take this loss and reflect on what they have done and the damage that they have inflicted on immigrant communities and the American people who support us. It is incumbent on all of us, Dreamers, DACA recipients, and our allies and supporters, U.S. citizens and beyond, to call on our elected leaders in Congress, specifically in the Senate, and call for the passage of H.R. 6, the Dream and Promise Act, so that we do not have to undergo this issue once again.
All right, he's talking about H.R. 6, the American Dream and Promise Act. Danny, what is that, first of all?
Well, that's something that would effectively make some of the protections that DACA had in place, the ability for people that came here undocumented as children to work and have the right to hold jobs and get certain public benefits, but most of those are decades down the line, like Social Security and Medicare, that this would actually be a congressional move, which would remove, you know, the president's role or the executive's role in this to some degree, because it would make it an actual law, which has been at the core of this issue all along. So, this just came down. It's not really clear right now if this Senate has the appetite for taking something like that up. The House probably could pass something like this. I believe they already have taken votes on it on something similar in the past. But the open question at this point, especially with this opinion today, is whether there's an appetite for that in the Senate. We'll just have to see.
Tim, you know, come back to this, the fears that DACA recipients had before today's decision. Those are very real fears that you mentioned. Let's go back to Romina Montenegro, who you spoke with. This is what she said about this ongoing fight.
It's very scary to know that the Trump administration could do whatever they want. You know, they could definitely hit us with a different way, because this laid out how not to do it. So they can do the exact opposite, come back and do it, quote unquote, the right way. And so they absolutely can hit us with it. But I personally believe that there may not be the sufficient time, because they're focusing on Trump's reelection. I don't think there's enough time for it.
Tim, what do you think? What do you think? The fear of re-election of Trump. What did you get out of what she just said?
I think what this boils down to is this the raw political question of how important was this to Trump's base. You mentioned earlier, Lewis, that about two-thirds of even conservatives think the DACA program was a good thing, the humane thing to do for people who were brought here as kids, etc. You have to keep in mind, though, that the other third of those conservatives are Trump's base. And the political calculation being made in the White House now, I would think, is that how important was this to that one third of conservatives who make up our base? And how important then is it for us to now, between now and the November election, gin this up again and at least make the gesture of showing that we're going to fight for this still? To appease that base that we need to come out in November for him to get re-election. So as I said, it's a very raw political calculation right now. And I think whether or not we see the Trump administration sort of bounce back and keep fighting on this in the next 5 months depends, as I said, on how important this was, how angry is his base about this ruling today.
For both of you, Danny, I'll start with you. How this ruling plays out for the coverage of immigration here in South Florida and, you know, future stories you might be looking into. You know, what are you thinking about? What comes next?
It is a pretty significant thing. And there's with COVID-19 and the reality of that, a lot of people who were DACA recipients actually were unable to get certain federal benefits because they were considered as kind of not having a legal status, and especially with this court case in limbo. Now that opens up a different reality for those people. And I think the reality of this major ruling, along with the one we got earlier this week about LGBTQ protections in the workplace, certainly will be something that a lot of more liberal-minded people are elated for. These are big victories, and I expect them to be a big part of a lot of campaign rhetoric on both sides, certainly.
And Tim, what about you? Where else does this story go now?
I think in the long term, if the Trump administration does not bounce back and keep fighting this, if it just lets this ruling go, and as Danny said before, just lets the clock run out between now and November, I think what it's going to do psychologically for this country is make the public and even Congress, I think, a lot more comfortable with the idea of pursuing immigration reform, more interested in setting our broken immigration system right, because I think there's going to be sort of a blanket feeling that, okay, this kind of program, this kind of what most Americans consider a humane program in the immigration sphere, was the correct thing to do. And so maybe immigration reform is the correct thing to do. And I think in the long run, this could open the door wider to more comprehensive immigration reform in this country that's so desperately needed.
And we still have a big election still coming up in November. We've been talking again with WLRN America's correspondent Tim Padgett and WLRN reporter Danny Rivero. You can follow their reporting on this at WLRN.org. Tim, Danny, thanks so much.
Thanks, Lewis.
Thanks for having us.
All right, still to come, what is your evacuation plan if a major storm comes this way? A look at how the pandemic may change those plans. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, hurricane season continues to creep up on us earlier and earlier. For the sixth year in a row, there was a named storm before the season officially started. There's now a request from an Orlando congresswoman, Stephanie Murphy, to officially extend the season. Well, needless to say, if you haven't set up a plan for your family and bought your supplies, now is as good a time as any. And part of that plan, by the way, has to be, if a major storm comes this way, can you stay at home or do you evacuate? Your plans may be different because of COVID. Emergency operations managers have had to rethink shelters because of social distancing, and now those shelters also have to have more safety gear, masks, gloves, etc. We're joined now by Shannon Davis-Weiner, the Director of Emergency Management in Monroe County. Ms. Weiner, thank you so much for the time today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
So how different is your preparation and your concern about the hurricane season now that you have a pandemic on top of all that?
So our basic plans are the same, in particular when it comes to sheltering. We have had to add, a whole nother angle to how we plan and think about how we shelter during a pandemic. A lot of different things you'll see if you do indeed need to go to a shelter. A lot of different processes are going to be in place to make sure that everyone can maintain their social distance and stay healthy. You know, beginning with if you must evacuate to a shelter, you know, we will be here for you and we are working to make it safe. You'll see things like health screenings and temperature checks, you know, when you come to check in. Each individual will receive their own set of wipes or hand sanitizers. We encourage you to bring a face mask, and you'll be required to wear a face mask, but we will provide you with one if you need one. And go moving on to increase space per person, increase square footage so that we can maintain that social distancing. And those are just a few of the things that we, you know, we're going to be implementing this hurricane season.
And there's a challenge in that, but we'll get to sheltering here in a moment. Remind us of the process for evacuations during a hurricane. When do you announce an evacuation?
So depending on the level of threat in Monroe County, we either will evacuate for a Category 1 or a low 2 storm in county to local shelters. If it is a high Category 2 or greater, we evacuate to Miami-Dade County. Our shelters there are at FIU and the Fuchs Pavilion at the fairgrounds. So, and of course, we evacuate persons with special needs first. Right along with visitors and residents of RVs or mobile homes, and then our general population follows after that.
And, you know, we talk about evacuations, you know, part of it is, again, because you're the islands, so there's a lot more risk than being on the mainland. But does anything have to do with, like, the person's home, whether that home is elevated or, the you know, what kind of construction they have as to whether or not they have to evacuate? Are those evacuations mandatory?
Depending on the level of a storm, if it is a high 2 or above, the evacuations for Monroe County are mandatory. Our whole county is in a flood zone. So any residence in Monroe County is in a flood zone versus on the mainland, where sometimes it's safe to shelter at home or you may or may not be in a flood zone. We, due to storm surge, you know, an island, an island is very vulnerable to that. So we do evacuate for a Category 2 or higher out of county for Monroe.
So some of the stuff that we were hearing, you know, before hurricane season was because of social distancing, because of the pandemic, that there was a question of whether or not we would ask some people to just stay home. That hasn't changed, right? When we talk about evacuations, once you reach those level hurricanes, everybody's got to get out, right? The pandemic hasn't changed that?
For Monroe County, yes. So if it, again, it goes back to, you know, the intensity of the storm. If we can evacuate in county in Monroe, so for that low 2 or Category 1, and your home is safe, is structurally safe to stay there, then we encourage you always to shelter at home or with family or friends first, if it is in a safe area. But once we hit that high 2, you know, along with it comes a dangerous surge, and that is when we want to evacuate our residents out of county. And we encourage them, you know, many have plans to go to a hotel on the mainland or to stay with friends or relatives on the mainland, and we encourage that. A shelter is always, you know, your backup plan, it should be, if you can, because they, again, they're not the most comfortable place, and we talk about, you know, congregate sheltering, which is the group sheltering, and non-congregate, which is non-group sheltering. But, you know, we want to be able to have the options available for you to keep you safe if you need to.
You know, there are people who just refuse to evacuate. They're convinced they'll be safe. They'll ride it out. They'll be okay. Now you add on top of that, well, you know, we have low rate of infection in the Keys. Last thing we want to do is go to the mainland and bring it back. How do you prepare for that conversation?
Right. Well, and, you know, and again, and we really encourage people that that if it's not safe, we won't ask you to leave unless it isn't safe. You know, we're very cognizant of that in the Keys. We knew, for instance, when Hurricane Irma was coming, we had additional lead time on that. And we said, we know the storm is coming. We know that it's not going to be safe here. It is mandatory that you leave. Now, this year, if we were to find ourselves in the same situation, we would again encourage them to go and to know that if you must leave, we are working to make it safe for you.
Again, talking with Shannon Davis Weiner, Director of the Emergency Management in Monroe County, talking about evacuation plans during a hurricane in the middle of a pandemic. And again, just a reminder, you know, we're in hurricane season, so when's a good time to get your supplies and have your plan? Should have done it yesterday. So do it as soon as possible. Don't wait. You know, you think about the risk of individuals bringing the virus back into the Keys after evacuations. Is there any coordination with local officials to do contact tracing, temperature checks? I mean, as people are coming back, how do you protect the Keys?
Right. So reentry into the Keys after a mandatory evacuation, we would follow the protocol we normally do. Usually we open up by zone depending on, if the roads are clear and safe and people are able to travel. We do need to have our public health system in place before we let people back in. Our hospitals need to be up and running, and our doctor's offices need to be capable of seeing patients. So that is absolutely a consideration. And I don't know that there would be any additional protective measures. We would still be under the, you know, the order to maintain your social distance, to wear a face mask, which is now mandatory in Monroe County. Both, you know, in situations where you can't social distance and while you are moving about out in public. So those measures would be in place for all of our first responders that would come in to assist and our aid workers that come in to assist, as well as our residents. So that is kind of, you know, we're operating as all those protective individual measures are the new normal. And if you are, you know, out and about in public, if you go to a shelter, if you evacuate and come back, those are, you know, a new normal here in Monroe County.
And you talk about shelters. So let's go back to that part of the conversation. You know, it used to be we'd send people to like schools and gyms and places like that. But because, again, of social distancing, we have to rethink that space. So how are you going to keep people apart from each other and still safe? What are the new rules?
So if you come to a shelter in Monroe County and you are showing signs of illness, we have set up for in our schools isolation areas. So we're taking advantage of the space that, you know, that a school shelter provides you. Normally, we try to keep everyone, you know, in one area of the school or in the gymnasium or in the auditorium. But given the COVID circumstances, we are going to be able to set isolation areas up by utilizing classrooms and other parts of the campus. We will also be doing something called podding, where you shelter family groups or small friend groups together. So you're not necessarily overexposing people to individuals that they haven't come in contact with before. So a lot of different strategies that we're using both in county and then at our out-of-county shelters as well.
What about hotels? I've heard that hotels might be used.
Sure, hotels are a possibility, and we do have contracts with some providers here in county, and we're working on out-of-county contracts as well. In the event that you cannot set up an isolation area, then or you have additional special needs, we want to be able to put you in a hotel space and where you can be completely isolated. But we need to be mindful too, because we want to be able to provide, you know, for the safety and security, as well as, you know, the basic feeding and care of those people as well. So it does bring up additional staffing considerations, but it is definitely an option that's on the table and ready to be put in play if we need to utilize it.
Do you have enough equipment? Do you need more volunteers for all of this?
Absolutely. We work very hard pre-hurricane season to make sure that we have enough staff for our shelters. And this year, this season under a pandemic, we will need more staff than we usually do for sheltering. You need additional additional facility support. We need medical support in the shelters. We've reached out to our Medical Emergency Reserve Corps here in Monroe County to ask for volunteers to come and work in those shelters, to be on staff, to set up an isolation area if needed and care for those types of individuals. The increased health screenings, if we have medical volunteers to do that as well, that's something that, you know, we're working on, increased staffing plans, because shelters are going to be a little bit different this year.
Let me finish with this. I want you to think back to Irma when it struck the Keys, and from all the lessons that we learned, think about the experience before, during, and after. Now add the pandemic on top of that. What would scare you most?
It just adds another incredible layer of challenge. I would not be scared. We have the knowledge, we have the resources, we have the ability, but it would be a lot of hard work for a lot of people. I will tell you this, though, in Monroe County and in the field of emergency management, we are very resilient, and we are there to help out each other. And we are very good at coming together in times of need. So not scared, but definitely a new level of challenge if that were to be the situation. But, you know, we're going to be prepared for it.
And, you know, you think about, for example, after the storm, if people are still in shelters because of damage or anything like that, if somebody does contract the virus, you know, what's the plan? Do you have to evacuate the shelter?
So you would handle a shelter that might be infected the same way you would if you were to have a family that has an infection or a workplace. The Department of Health does come in. They do the contact tracing. They do the additional testing. And we set up isolation areas for those that need them. And in that case, that would be, you know, you're looking at a longer term isolation. A shelter might not be open for 14 days. It might be open for 7. That's when that non-congregate hotel facility comes into play, as providing that extra level of shelter for an individual that might be infected.
Well, having said all that, fingers crossed, we don't have to worry about it this year. Talking again with Shannon Davis Weiner, Director of the Emergency Management in Monroe County. Ms. Weiner, thank you so much. I appreciate the time.
Thank you. You have a good day.
And again, reminder, it's hurricane season, so make that plan. Go out, get your supplies. Still to come, tomorrow is Juneteenth. South Florida will be commemorating the holiday through a film about the McDuffie Rebellion. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Juneteenth commemorates the day emancipation reached enslaved people in the deepest parts of the South, when a Union general went into Galveston, Texas, and announced they're now free. That was June 19, 1865, over 2 years after the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation. It became an official state holiday in Texas in 1980, and that was around the same time the McDuffie Rebellion was happening here in Miami. That uprising exploded after the death of Arthur McDuffie, a black man, at the hands of police. Violence and rage began after the Miami-Dade County police officers were then found not guilty. To commemorate Juneteenth, tomorrow, the Miami Film Festival is making the documentary available online that tells the McDuffie story. It's called When Liberty Burns. By the way, we want to hear from you. How are you commemorating Juneteenth? Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. You can always email us, sundial@WLRNnews.org. Femi Falmalami Brown helped produce When Liberty Burns, and she was in Miami when the McDuffie Rebellion happened, and she joins us now. Ms. Brown, thank you so much for the time.
You're quite welcome.
You're in Miami when the rebellion broke out in 1980. You actually saw firsthand, you know, when McDuffie was stopped by police. Take me back. What do you think about when you remember that moment?
I was not present when McDuffie was stopped by police. I was in the area of Northwest 62nd Street and 12th Avenue when a car was attacked after it hit a young black girl. McDuffie was actually stopped in December the following year prior.
I stand corrected. Thank you for correcting me on that. Okay. But you were there when all of this broke out. Tell me a little bit about what was life like, first of all, before the rebellion.
Well, we were having a normal community. I was here visiting my mother with two daughters. We were actually living in Lagos, Nigeria. And I made a trip over to search for a house to buy. When the announcement that the officers had been found not guilty was broadcast on the radio, there was just, I think, shock. My first thought was to get to my mother to share that shock with her, because I happened to have been alone at the house. But as soon as I got in my car and entered the streets, I saw that there were people there already, and they were very, very excited in not a good way. And it was just a simultaneous burst of energy, negative energy and amazement that the officers could have been found not guilty.
And where were you? What were you doing at the time? As all this is happening, were you out there in the middle of it, or were you trying to hide from it?
Well, no, I was. I lived in North Dade. My mother lived in the Brownsville area, approximately two blocks from the Norton Tire Company, which became one of the landmark buildings that was destroyed during the rebellion. And because my daughters happened to have been at my mother's house, my first thought was to just go there so that I could, I wanted to talk to my mom about how could they, because I had not been living in the country for almost 7 years before this occurred. And certainly I thought, as everyone did, that justice would be served. So, just remarkably, as I was leaving the area where I lived to go to my mother's house, by the time I reached Northwest 62nd Street and 12th Avenue, a crowd of people had already began the rebellion, or riots, as they called it. I don't like to call it that, because they called it the McDuffie riots, and Mr. McDuffie had nothing to do with that. It was brought on because the officers were found not guilty.
Yeah. And what's the one memory that jumps out at you most about, again, once the rebellion was underway, and again, the number of people that were hurt and killed and arrested in that time, and you had fires and police, you had the National Guard come in. What was the one memory that jumps out at you, though?
Well, for me, I happened to have volunteered with an organization called the Center for Family and Child Enrichment. And as with this current protest, I was struck by the number of young people in the streets, and we were asked to go out after curfew to encourage them to go home so they wouldn't be arrested. So my interest was in making sure that, one, they did not completely destroy the community that we lived in, and that they not be arrested and have records that would haunt them for the rest of their lives. Certainly I understood the anger, but I did think that we could direct it in a more positive way. And with the organization that I was working with, we tried to do so.
When and where did the idea for this film come up?
Dudley Alexis is the young filmmaker that did a great job in producing, directing, and editing the film. And he came up with the idea after one of his friends was shot and killed by a police officer. I met Dudley after the premiere of his first movie, which was Liberty in the Soup, about the Haitian Revolution and how soup jumeau became the national dish of Haiti. I happened to have been at the Miami-Dade Cultural Arts Center, the African Heritage Center, again on 62nd Street and 22nd Avenue, not very far from where my mother lived. And I was really amazed at the quality of his first documentary. And because I had worked with kids, I thought that the documentary should be shown in Miami-Dade County Public Schools. Having been a friend of Dr. Dorothy Mendenhall, I wanted to bring the film to her attention. So that was my first contact with Dudley Alexis. Because I had also been a documentary filmmaker quite a long time ago, I thought that I would offer to help him do some research. And that's how I got involved.
And, you know, we spoke with Dudley back in March, and he said you were essential in getting the family to open up to do the documentary. How did you do that?
Well, I am in the age group of the family, particularly the elder sister, Forstine Reed, and I'm an excellent cook, so I bribed my way in with seafood gumbo, in both cases, with the daughter and with Miss Forestine. And it didn't take very much after that. We both love our brothers. I have one brother who means the world to me. He's a former correctional officer. He's been in the military, much like Mr. McDuffie had. And in doing the research and reviewing some of the archival footage, I remember when Judge Nesbitt said that the name McDuffie had come to be synonymous with rioting and with police brutality against Black people, etc. And I thought, you know, they really sullied the McDuffie name, you know? So it became a mission for me to help, you know, change that if at all possible, because he was loved. And that's what we wanted to hear. We wanted to hear who the man really was and what he meant to not just his family, but to his friends, his classmates, what he might have been had he lived. And I think the film successfully did that.
There's something, the other thing that's interesting too about this is how different generations think about it. But so in the film, we hear from a number of people. One of them is Lonnie Lawrence. This is a childhood friend of McDuffie's, and he's a retired police officer.
I think a lot of young people have no idea what McDuffie was. No idea. And as a matter of fact, I don't think it. I know it.
So he says that, you know, younger people don't know who McDuffie was. And this goes back to what you said. You wanted to also change the narrative of how people look back at McDuffie. But, you know, and again, going back to Dudley, the director, he had said it too. He grew up in Miami. He didn't know who McDuffie was until he was working on this film.
Exactly.
Why do you think there's a lack of knowledge and education about a history, especially that history, in our community?
Well, there were other incidences after Mr. McDuffie. And I think that there was a concerted effort to change the image of Miami. I know people that came here from with the government to specifically investigate. And in doing so, you know, Miami is a tourist city, and one cannot attract tourists to a place where there has been that kind of damage. So, you know, there was a very concerted effort to quash that memory. and to change the face and the perception of what Miami was. And quite a large budget was used to do so. And you know, they did a good job of it.
That's an interesting it's an interesting perspective I had not thought of. Again, just to mention, I'm talking with film producer Femi Falami Brown. She worked on the documentary When Liberty Burns about Miami's history of racism and police brutality. That, by the way, the Miami Film Festival is screening the documentary online tomorrow in commemoration of Juneteenth. And we mentioned Juneteenth earlier. We'd love to hear from you how you're commemorating Juneteenth. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Ms. Brown, you're the grandmother of a young black male. What are the conversations you have with him about McDuffie? And then, of course, also now everything that's going on with George Floyd.
Well, also, because we're in the middle of a pandemic, the last time I saw my grandson was last weekend. But prior to that, I had not seen him in, 3 months at the premiere of the film. And it is a hard conversation to have. I remember just a year ago, I was babysitting or child sitting with him while his mother was on a business trip. And I posted on Facebook that I dropped him off at the bus stop in Plantation, Florida. And I realized he was the only child at the bus stop in that neighborhood, which is a upper middle class neighborhood. And I could not pull away. There was an innate fear of leaving him unprotected. So with that said, you can imagine how I must be feeling now, having to encounter the same fear only intensified. I realized that while we tried to shield him from, what is a harsh reality, we can no longer do that. So we are having that conversation, and we are letting him know that he is loved, he is valued, he matters, and that we will do all we can to protect him. And we will do that with love, and we will have the conversations, the tough conversations, not necessarily with him, but with others who are not people of color, so that perhaps we can influence, the way the world looks at black boys and black men.
Do you talk to him about Juneteenth? And I wondered, for you, like growing up, what did that mean? What did Juneteenth mean? What does it mean
absolutely
for you now?
Absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. It was a regional holiday in Texas that just became a state holiday in 1980, 79 or 80. And here in Miami, I did not learn about Juneteenth until perhaps a decade ago. Much like the slaves didn't find out they were free until 2.5 years later. This again points to how our history was muddled, and the narrative was, we were not given privy to the actual history of black people, not until archives and digital information became available and we started doing our own research, and now we can correct the narrative. I personally would not celebrate Juneteenth as a happy holiday, because it just underscores the idea that, black people were kept enslaved for an additional 2.5 years. But I do understand that, we want to have a holiday like Kwanzaa, like Juneteenth, that we can celebrate our people and our culture. So while I'm rather old school and as a researcher, I have a particular perspective. I do understand that it is catching on and that other states have declared it a holiday. And I'm not sure of the status of Florida, but as a kid, and I checked with a neighbor who is younger, but had lived in Texas and grew up in Miami. And she told me that outside of, you know, Texas, you know, she had not celebrated it either.
Right.
So, yeah, it's catching on.
Yeah, there's a lot more we could talk about this, but I just want to remind folks, too, that, again, you know, for Juneteenth tomorrow, that, again, the documentary When Liberty Burns is going to be available online. We'll have more information on our social media, WLRN Sundial. I can tell you, having seen it, powerful, make you rethink history in Miami. Ms. Brown, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
You are more than welcome.
Femi Falami Brown, again, worked on the documentary When Liberty Burns about Miami's history of racism and police brutality. And again, just go to our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, that's our program for this Thursday, June 18th. Coming up next week on the show, we're going to continue to follow the protest this weekend against police violence happening in South Florida. We'll also keep an eye on Juneteenth activities happening tomorrow. And again, find us on social media and share with us the events that you should be following, that we should be following, I should say, and how, again, you're commemorating Juneteenth. Also, teachers across South Florida had to end the 2020 school year without saying farewell to their students. And that was really hard for some teachers, those who are retiring. We're going to hear from a panel of teachers about their decision to retire now and the climate of education. By the way, if you're a teacher retiring, we'd love to hear from you. Find us online. Just email us, actually. It's the easiest way. Sundial at WLRNnews.org. If you're a retiring teacher, we'd love to hear from you. And by the way, guess what? We're bringing back the Sundial Book Club. It's coming back for July. Next week, we'll give you more details about the first book for season 3 of the book club. And always find us on Facebook, Sundial Book Club. Ask to join. We'd love to have you. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a great Friday, a great weekend. We'll talk to you again live on Monday.